This is episode 63 of the Fifth Estate podcast. Liam Donovan on DACA, Trump, Schumer, and Pelosi.
Hey there, folks. Neil Doing here with a word from our friends at Away Travel. You know, your luggage shouldn't cost more than your plane ticket. Away Travel's luggage is designed with the highest quality materials, and it's still under $300. They can do this because they cut out the middleman and sell directly to you. You know, it comes in a variety of colors and four sizes. Carry-on, bigger carry-on, the medium, or the large for extended stays. All suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, which is unrivaled in strength and impact resistance, while also being very lightweight. The interior features a patent-pending compression system, which is helpful for overpackers. It has four 360-degree spinner wheels, which guarantee a smooth ride. Need I go on? There is so much to love about Away Travel's luggage. Personally, I'm a huge fan of the built-in USB. How often have you been out in an airport looking for an outlet? And guess what? All those losers are just camped out. Every outlet is filled. No longer. A single charge of the Away carry-on will charge your iPhone five times. That's crazy. I also have to say, the compression system, lifesaver. You wouldn't expect this, but I'm the overpacker in my family. I'm always wanting to bring an extra pair of shoes, an extra pair of pants. I pack for a weekend like I'm going away for a month. It's awful. So, compression system, top notch. Let's see what else we have here. We got, you know, a lifetime warranty, 100-day trial. There's free shipping on any Away order within the lower 48 states. There is just so much to love about Away Travel, my friends. So I do hope that you will give them a chance. Right now, we've got a special offer. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/fifth and use promo code fifth during checkout. One more time, that's awaytravel.com/fifth and use promo code fifth at checkout for $20 off any suitcase. You won't regret it. Happy travels.
All right, it's time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Well, I'm on my feet. That's about all I can say.
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm alive.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, we don't want you to do the show in a comatose state or dead or
anything. Well, no, I wouldn't be comatose, but I got to tell you, the one thing keeping me going is the hope that perhaps our listeners out there who enjoy the show will respond to that, will give us a 5-star review on iTunes.
Yes.
Maybe tell their friends and family about the show.
Yeah, I agree. I think that would
pass the word.
Exactly. Tell everybody. Tell them to subscribe, leave a review, do the whole thing. So
it's the only thing that gets my heart rate up anymore these days, gotta say.
No, that's too bad. Well, that's interesting, but we'll hopefully that'll work out for you, and we'll see that. So all right, so you know, after a relatively quiet August for the most part, we've had, you know, of course, Hurricane Harvey, you know, and what happened with Houston, and then got Hurricane Irma is on its way to Florida. And in between the two hurricanes, we have Hurricane Trump doing a bunch of stuff. And our shows have been more or less around some other subjects and not around current events. But enough stuff happened in the last week and a half probably that we decided we wanted to talk about it.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And, you know, we decided to bring someone on who would be able to, you know, catch us up, catch our listeners up, and speak intelligently on the goings on. So we've brought in Liam Donovan to the show. Welcome, Liam.
Gentlemen, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm doing okay, Liam, I got to say. Can't complain. So, Liam, since it's your first time on the show, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background, what you do?
First time on the show, yeah. So I'm, I guess, you know, as of about a year and a half ago or so, I was just a random guy on Twitter, and was able to sort of parlay that into a little bit of writing here or there, a little bit of media stuff. But stepping back, big picture, my day job is I don't know if you can say this. I think actually a certain internet website that I often patronize describe me as sneeringly as a Republican lobbyist, which is a true statement of fact. I am a Republican lobbyist. I focus mostly on tax issues. So I follow this stuff and get paid for it, which is great, but also have a lot of fun with it, bantering with you guys, and appreciate you having me on.
Thanks. And for those of you who are wondering, Liam Donovan is, you probably recognize him as that guy from Revenge of the Nerds, Stan Gable. If you follow Liam on Twitter at LP Donovan, his longtime avatar has been a photo of the character Stan Gable kind of doing the thumbs down at the Greek Council. So great character,
you know,
and very
Stan now has a Make America Great Again hat because he earned it the hard way by shooting off his mouth about maybe how a certain member of the Republican conference was going to vote on Obamacare repeal. So he's now likes to make America great again.
Oh, so he's a MAGA guy now. He's not one of those dirty establishment
people.
He
is. That was in lieu of at LP Donovan himself getting a tattoo. So it's, you know, I'm just doing the bare minimum here.
All right. So Liam, let's talk first. Let's talk a little bit about, we really want to talk, I think we'll spend more time on Trump and Pelosi and them, but let's go through DACA for a few minutes here and just kind of unwrap that. DACA, of course, for people that don't know, is the program that allowed not so much children, but if kids were brought here by their parents illegally, if they were kids before a certain amount of time, I think there's an age limit, then they're not granted any kind of legal status, but they are allowed to apply for like work permits, and they can get driver's licenses. There's things that they can do to kind of allow them to stay in the country without fear of deportation. And President Obama implemented this after the Dream Act couldn't get passed. President Obama pretty much argued that he didn't have the authority to do it, but he did it anyway. And Trump became president, and I guess it was maybe 10 to a dozen state attorneys general threatened a lawsuit to say, you know, the president didn't have the authority to do this, and if you don't end it, then we're going to file suit. Donald Trump did end it, and of course, everything kind of went crazy after that in terms of the response. So what do you think? I mean, from your perspective, was he right in doing what he did? Did he have the right to do what he did? And what do you think about the lawsuits? Now, interestingly enough, some states have filed lawsuits against Donald Trump for rescinding DACA and saying that he acted unconstitutionally in doing it. So there's a whole bunch of stuff to unpack there.
Yeah, I mean, I think my sense is based on, you know, it's what, September 7th or whatever. The fact that he's doing this now means that there's certainly some ambivalence. He was reluctant to do it. He knows it's a political hot potato. And his stated comments really, you know, he realizes this is not a great political position. You know, on the merits, you know, there's a principled argument for this, absolutely, and probably the right argument from a legal standpoint. If you look at on a parallel track, there was the DAPA, situated deferred action for the parents of these dreamers was less popular, less defensible, and was enjoined by the federal courts. And so the same logic would apply. And to your point about some of the things that President Obama said for years leading up to 2012 when he signed this executive action, you know, if we're in an environment where the courts are going to use the candidate or the president's words against them. You know, the president saying explicitly that he can't do this over and over, you know, is not a great look. So I think there's certainly a strong argument for DACA itself being extra constitutional, let's say. I think that he promised to do this and boxed himself in. I also think that Congress largely likes having this. They would prefer not to deal with this, even if you aren't crazy about the constitutionality of it or even the policy. It's not an issue you necessarily want to deal with. So I look at this as Trump's hand being forced by the attorneys general that you mentioned. Their suit was going to be effective, you know, I think they said the 5th, and so of course this was handed down on the 4th or whichever day it was. Their hand was forced. They did it in a way to try to pass the baton and limit the blowback. So they've been able to sort of have it both ways to some degree. Obviously been excoriated in very explicit terms by the former president, President Obama, by the Democratic leadership and that sort of thing. But he's been very measured. There's been an interesting good cop, bad cop, not in a strategic sense, but in a sort of like Lego movie sense. It's one minute it's Jeff Sessions saying X, and then it's President Trump saying, no, we like the Dreamers, that, you know, we've got a lot of heart for these guys and that sort of thing. So it's mixed signals being sent to Congress, and 6 months doesn't give them a whole ton of time to deal with these issues. So I don't know if that answered every one of our questions here, but I do think that that there's a very defensible case for this. I just think that he was backed into a corner, and this was sort of out of his hand being forced rather than any kind of real principle at stake.
So what about then, do you think there's enough Republicans will get behind a bill that will do this? I mean, from the leadership position, some of the things that they were saying. I mean, now Mitch McConnell didn't seem to kind of go in that direction, but Paul Ryan did. And then some other Republicans in the Senate were saying, hey, we need to do something here. And my guess is, and I'm saying, I think there's probably enough Republican support along with all the Democratic support in order to get something signed, simply because, it's funny. Somebody asked me about the policy, and I said, I was kind of torn about it. I said, I understand somebody who's been brought here when they were 5 years old and they've lived here for 20 years or whatever it may be, to say, well, you need to go back to your homeland. Well, they don't really know any other place than here. And I'm inclined to allow them to stay. I just don't think that they should get, like a legal stay. There should be no like citizenship, no path. And
right.
I'm wondering if that's where you're going to get some fighting between Republicans and Democrats. I think Democrats are going to want to have the path to citizenship. Republicans are going to say no, and you're going to have a mess. But I mean, if it was to go the route of, say, just allowing them to stay and kind of keeping them legal, do you think there's enough Republican support there to do that?
I do think that'll be the stumbling block, because people can agree on the broad contours of these people should not be deported, aggressively or otherwise. This is a fixable situation. The scale is not overwhelming. But I do think, there's two things at play. Number one, the level of support, the sort of latent support there. The votes are there. More than 218 votes are there. The question is, can it satisfy the Republican conference such that it's not Paul Ryan taking his career into his own hands by putting something on the floor that doesn't have the majority support, the so-called Hastert rule, whatever we're calling it now, that Denny Hastert's persona non grata. I think that a lot of that will depend on, your point, which was, what do you do with them then? Are you creating a permanent sort of purgatory of second-class citizens? That's sort of, that might be the way to split the baby, but that's going to be beaten up on pretty well. I think a lot of it will have to do with the sort of cover that the president gives. He needs to be explicit. I think he's getting there. I think, as we'll get to it later in the show, I guess, but with Speaker Pelosi sort of nudging him, he came out and, assured the Dreamers that they would not be have anything to worry about over the next 6 months, as they sort of give Congress the chance to do this. But he's sort of tried to have it both ways. There's a little bit of a two-step going on. The messaging of his formal statements have been very heavy on, we're a country of laws, and you know, we need to do things that will look out for the American worker. And these are all code for the sorts of things that the Jeff Sessions, the Steve Miller, even Steve Bannon wing are looking for. And so that's where you get some of the proposals of, you know, Tom Cotton saying, yeah, I'm okay with legalizing these dreamers, but it would have to be paired with something that protects the American worker, like the RAISE Act that had been endorsed by the president not so long ago. And so those are sort of more posturing, I think, than anything else. But it does get you into a situation where you could have an interesting trade for, let's say, you know, maybe not, it's depends how these things are couched, but they're only looking for a measly $1.8 billion in wall funding, and you can call that what you want, but he just wants to get started and have something to tout. And so there is or was some leverage there to make a deal. And now that we've sort of consummated this Trump Schumer Pelosi triumvirate, then maybe there's something there. But I do think the hand is rather weak now that he is publicly expressed ambivalence, if not outright support, for continuing DACA as a legislative provision. So
Liam, what is the politically advantageous move for Republicans? You know, I think that anytime you talk about immigration reform of any sort, you're going to run afoul of a group of hardliners on the right who will, you know, just vehemently oppose anything short of deport them. So what should Republicans do? I mean, what can they realistically do? What's the right move for them?
I mean, it's an incredibly tough issue, and you almost have two different conversations about what's the right substantive policy and what's politically saleable, and you know, trying to square that circle is not always the easiest thing in the world. I think there's significant scar tissue built up over the last 3 years, 4 years, I guess, if we're talking going back to 2013. You saw, you know, political hopes derailed in Senator Rubio. You saw a potential speakership you know, preempted in Eric Cantor. I think there's a profound fear within the Republican conference, even among people who might otherwise be amenable to some of the more comprehensive solutions. I think people realize that comprehensive is a dirty word. You have to take things up in, I mean, there's an utter lack of good faith, both within the Republican conference, among the you know, the two parties within Congress, and then broadly, because everyone outside of D.C. hates D.C., hates Congress. And so I think there's so much bad faith. There has to be sort of a down payment. And with something like the policies provided for in DACA, you have the outlines of something that's rather popular. You know, certainly majority, depending on who you ask and how you phrase it, maybe, you know, 80%, something like that. So that's something. If you could pair it with maybe something the Hawks want, like E-Verify, or something that could be palatable, I think there's something there. And that's how you do the politically safe and sort of the 70-30 issues first. Even the RAISE Act, while I think it is sort of the skills frame is a red herring, because it's really more about cutting legal immigration. The idea of a skills-based immigration system is a popular one, and one that you could pull off if you weren't simultaneously trying to cut legal immigration in half. So there are a number of things that I think are doable. It's just that you need to do them sort of piecemeal. You need to build some good faith and trust, which is just in completely short supply right now.
Well, I mean, even if you do get something onto Trump's desk that he wants to sign, I mean, will his supporters punish the Republicans for it? You know, it's something Trump has signaled a willingness to sign, but I can't think that many of his supporters would be too pleased with it. But would they necessarily punish Trump? No, I think that probably part of the calculus here is that the Republicans in Congress could deliver what the president has clearly signaled that he might want, and then they take the brunt of the political backlash for it.
I think, I mean, this is precisely what we're seeing sort of in miniature right now with the, you know, the deal we'll get to later. But yeah, I think that's a real concern, which is why I think it's important for Trump to be explicit about what he is asking for. It can't be sort of signals that he would accept this. It has to be him asking Congress to do this, because otherwise they know that they could easily be hung out to dry, depending on what the news cycle said, you know, on any given day. So I think that's absolutely a peril that they appreciate in a profound way.
And Liam, what about the legal challenge? I'm not sure if you're an attorney or not. I know I'm not. But it seems to me, you know, and of course, every time you say, well, it seems common sense, you know, the law will kind of like throw a curveball at you. But it's funny that these states are filing a lawsuit against Donald Trump, saying that he doesn't have the authority to rescind something that Obama created through the same means. I mean, so I'm sure they'll shop for a federal judge that might give them, you know, a breather for a little while. But I can't imagine the courts kind of, you know, siding with them. Do you?
Yeah. I mean, full disclosure, I am not an attorney. But no, I think that's about right. And I think it's as much a political statement as anything else. This is, if you're a Democratic attorney general right now, this is a no-brainer in the same way it was, if you were a Republican attorney general during the Obama administration to do sort of, you know, whatever the counterpoint was, whether it was for, you know, related to Obamacare or DACA or any number of DAPA, any number of things. So I think there's a political imperative that's being served by this. In terms of its actual chance of success, I think, you know, the successful at some levels in some circuits, the successful arguments related to the travel ban probably embolden these guys to say, not only is this politically the right move, there's also a chance that this, you know, if not, I think there's a realization that if it rises to the level of the Supreme Court, it's probably a moot point, particularly now with Justice Gorsuch on the court. But yeah, I think it is a sort of a requisite move at this point. It's the bare minimum that if you're a Democratic attorney general that you can do and say you're part of the resistance. In terms of its actual likelihood of success, it would not surprise me at all to have a similar situation like with the travel ban. But it's not nearly as obvious that there are sort of uncouth statements that would run afoul of any, there's nothing related. He was saying he would rescind DACA, He might have said bad things about certain ethnic groups and that sort of thing. But there, it would be hard to tie it together in the way that with the travel ban, it was first he was looking for a way to do it based on religious lines. And then he asked Rudy, how can I do this in a legal manner? So, as you rise up the court system, those sort of circumstantial arguments aren't going to be as strong, but I do think they could find some success and, you know, maybe raise a little money on the side, based on, some judges that are favorable towards the aims.
Sure. I don't think it'll go anywhere. And who knows? I mean, before there's even any kind of court cases or anything like that, there may be a bill signed if there's some kind of miracle. So, all right. So let's move on then to, you know, the big news this week. I mean, everyone was talking about there was going to be an aid package for Harvey. And you know, for all the time leading up to this discussion and everything, there was all this talk about, you know, there was going to be, you know, all the hypocrisy of people like Ted Cruz and everybody who voted against Sandy relief and who now were going to want relief for Texas. And, you know, so that kind of went away very fast when yesterday, well, I shouldn't say yesterday, I don't know if anybody's going to listen to this, but this past week, Donald Trump and had congressional leaders over to the White House, and he wound up striking a deal with Democratic leadership, Charles Schumer, Chuck Schumer, and Nancy Pelosi. Basically, it was revolving around the debt ceiling. Now, for years, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have said that using the debt ceiling as a negotiating tactic is out of line and it shouldn't happen, and they went and did it. And they said, we only want to give you a 3-month extension on the debt ceiling because they wanted to have a fiscal cliff kind of battle thing to set everything up in December. Republicans initially wanted 18 months. And apparently in this meeting, there was, you know, Republicans said, well, we want 18 months. Schumer and Pelosi said, no, we'll give you 3 months. Republicans said, okay, what about a year? No, we'll give you 3 months. Okay, how about 6 months? No, we'll give you 3 months. And then Trump said, deal. I have to say, I was highly amused at the people who for years were calling John Boehner, you know, a sellout and a traitor, and Paul Ryan a traitor for, you know, making deals that they kind of had to make in order to move the ball forward. Here's Trump in a position where, you know, he's a Republican. He's got a Republican Congress. And how Democrats are threatening to hold up an aid bill over the debt ceiling. I mean, couldn't you? And here's the thing. I was talking to somebody. I said, this is tailor-made for Donald Trump. He could go out there with his usual bluster and say, people are dying and they're holding up the, you know, they're holding up the funding for this. Why would he do what he did? Do you have any explanation for that?
Well, I think there's probably a chapter in The Art of the Deal that explains it all in full detail. but it is fascinating to watch. I think the most revealing thing has been in the response to it. And, you know, to Neil's point about where the blame lies, you know, there's just sort of an unwillingness to hold the president accountable for the things he does, or at least come up with some way that in a 4D chess sense, this was brilliant and, you know, sort of a genius strategy. I can't imagine there is a strategy served here, if only because it is the bare minimum that one could have come up with. It is the worst deal that could have been made. You know, as tragic as Harvey was and Irma's set up to be, there was never a chance that was going to be held up, which, you know, in a sort of, you know, morbid silver lining sense, that makes it bulletproof and the ultimate ride to catch for something like the debt limit, which is, you know, the ultimate nuisance. And if you are the party in power, it is something that you are going to have to pull a significant amount of weight on. The problem is in the recent future, or in the recent past with Republicans, you know, particular elements of the Republican Party that are unwilling to bite that bullet, they were always going to have to rely on Democratic votes, and they were probably, to get those small number of Democratic votes, they were probably going to have to make concessions that made it more, that moved the bill to the left and therefore required more Democratic votes. So it's sort of a ratchet that moves in the wrong direction. I think this was something, all I can imagine, the only thing served by this is it salved the president's ego. It allowed him to show who was boss and to show the leadership of the, you know, Republicans in the respective chambers. They're not the, you know, they've made plenty of what he, you know, clearly took as patronizing or otherwise, you know, unhelpful comments. He deems them insufficiently loyal. He's still, you know, wounded from the campaign trail when sort of said some not nice things. So the only thing served here from the standpoint of Republicans is, or you know, the cheering is based on pure schadenfreude that the leader and speaker got their comeuppance. And it's sort of twisted because there's literally nothing else served. Even from a Democratic standpoint, the benefit is by virtue of this is bad for Republicans, therefore it's good for Democrats. The bank shot is they're going to be in a much better position in 3 months. The best spin for Trump is this is him, doing the right thing, showing that he's a bipartisan deal maker, and he's cleared the decks for tax reform for 3 months, which isn't really true in any meaningful sense.
All of which presupposes that anything ever actually gets to his desk. I mean, I don't know. I really can't say with Congress or depending on whether the president puts in double the effort he put into repealing the Affordable Care Act, it might still
actually not be enough. You know, probably the best spin that I heard on this, and it wasn't spin so much as an attempt to glean some sort of benefit from this episode, was from Noah Rothman on the commentary podcast. And he suggested that this may actually, come back on the Democrats, because for 2 years now, they've been casting themselves as opponents of Trump, oppose everything he does, you know, oppose him at every turn. And then all of a sudden, here's the president making deals with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, and they have to sort of throw out a little bit of that playbook and say, okay, well, how do we make nice with this guy? And that might be somewhat awkward for them. But, I mean, even that, it sounds like if that even happens, if it throws the Democrats off, it would be an unintentional benefit, not something that the president really set out to do. Like, he's not trolling anyone, except
he might be trolling the leader and the speaker, but he's certainly not trolling the...
Right, that's just the sort of person you want to shepherd, you know, legislation through the government. You know, we have a Republican president with a Republican Congress, and instead of passing standard Republican legislation, this guy is hung up settling scores from the campaign with the two people he needs most. You know, this is the argument I never understood from the anti-establishmentarian types. It was like, you want to be the establishment. That's how you get your agenda passed. And so to be the establishment, you need to cozy up to the establishment. You know, so I just don't understand what possible spin anyone could put on this. So
I'll say this. I think there was probably a time for this sort of maneuver, you know, right out of the gate. And I think and you mentioned, you know, Noah Rothman's commentary podcast. He had a really good piece on, you know, looking at triangulation and whether this counted and, you know, whether it served any strategic or even tactical purpose. And I thought it was very good analysis. You know, what it drove home to me was there was a time for triangulation. And to Noah's point, which is, you know, it's one thing on a government funding deal. This is purely about keeping the lights on. And what they did was extract the best possible deal, short of America defaulting on its obligations and shutting the government down, which nobody would have wanted. So from the standpoint of the resistance or what have you, this is a great outcome because it is the worst possible outcome for Republicans, and it's completely fine for Democrats, and it probably gets them DACA codified in 3 months. I think it would be a different story if they cut a deal with President Trump for, let's say, infrastructure or something more transactional. In this case, it is the default action was going to be government funding rolling out, running out, and the you know, sovereign debt being betrayed.
You don't think anybody's going to try to shut down the government this time?
Well, I think we're going to pass tomorrow the 3 months. So I mean, at least from the House standpoint, I don't think anybody's going to shut down the Senate over it. So at least for 3 months, you bought yourself 3 months. That's the irony is some weeks ago before, you know, we had these epic storms. The conventional wisdom was that the President Trump was going to shut down the government over the wall. So that's how quickly these things change and are driven by events. So
Liam, what happens in December? What do we get? What's going to happen?
Well, so what you had happen this evening, it's going to be cut short tomorrow because people are heading home for the income impending storms. But the House is passing, in the process of passing, and will pass when they get back on Monday, the omnibus package of appropriations that gets you through the end of the 2018 fiscal year, so September 30th next year. Which goes to show you, 3 months was always going to be the government funding. Like, you were always going to have to deal with government funding in December. That's not an issue. You were always going to have to deal with, you know, certain other things on a short can kick like this. It was the debt ceiling, which is the existential threat, where you had the opportunity to hitch it and just forget about it and get it out of your hair for a significant period of time, and that's what they failed to do. So that's going to be the hard one in December. The funding piece shouldn't be that hard. They actually are doing significant bipartisan work in the Senate in particular. You'll have to hash out the difference between the House and the Senate, but government funding is not going to be hard. What's going to be hard is the inevitability of people voting for more debt, which is unpopular, and it polls poorly, and it draws challengers on the primary and that sort of thing. So, which goes back to my point, which is you only need so much Dem support for this stuff, but the price of the Dem support is going to drive away Republican support, and you end up with this sort of vicious circle. It's not going to be pretty. The negotiations are going to have to start weeks in advance, or else you're just going to have, you know, another 3-month can kick. And the Dems would love nothing more than to have this. They can run out the clock on the fruitful legislative window that Republicans have, which is slipping away as we speak. We just spent the last 8 months not doing health care, not doing tax reform, not doing infrastructure. And you've got, a remaining 9 legislative days left in this month. When they come back, we're still waiting on the phantom tax package that is yet to, make its debut. And the thing that everyone, I think, leaves out of their calculus is not only have to relitigate all the items that you just passed off for 3 months, not only do you not only is the ostensible reason for doing this getting through tax reform, which is going to be hard enough in its own right, you have to pass a budget resolution in order to do that tax reform. And right now that budget resolution doesn't have nearly the votes even to get through the House, which itself has no chance of flying in the Senate. So there's so much to be done from a procedural standpoint before you can actually do anything that counts as a win, that maybe that's the, it's not strategic, but maybe that's the impulse that President Trump is going for here. Is he can call this a win. He can, this is enough sort of out of the ordinary that, I mean, he's obviously loving the ratings of it. He called Nancy up this morning and said, "You're on TV all the time and we're doing great." So he obviously likes this feedback. He likes the feeling of getting wins. And so if that means, cutting 3-month deals with the Democrats for the foreseeable future, maybe that's what we'll do. But in the meantime, it gums up the works to do anything substantive, and the window is closing to do anything that's going to have any actual impact by the time the voters go to the polls next fall. So that's a long, rambling answer to the question, but it's going to be an ugly December. I think it definitely threatens the timetable for any kind of tax bill. I hesitate to say tax reform anymore, just because that's sort of there's a definitional question there. But if they can get a budget resolution, there will be a tax bill of some sort. It's just a question of what that looks like, what the scope is, what the scale is. But they have a finite period of time because they're going to have to pick this back up again and cut a really, really ugly deal that is going to be something that no one wants to vote for. And it's just a question of who you send to walk the plank, who are the, leadership, the folks who are not vulnerable, A, and B, have the loyalty of leadership to go do this, because it's going to be mostly done with then votes. Just by the nature of what you're dealing with, it's probably going to be, the heavy lifting is going to be done by Democrats, is my expectation.
Well, that doesn't portend well for Republicans. And so let's talk a little bit about, as we kind of close this out, though, one of the things that people are talking about and hearing about is retirements from the House. That there's, there's quite a number of members of Congress on the Republican side who are kind of fed up with the fact that you, maybe you can explain a little further. I would say the fact that, they're not getting anything done. They're not doing what they were sent there to do. And, it's these kind of these little battles like we just talked about, the debt ceiling and I think everyone's tired of it. I mean, I remember starting this and following this going back, 20 something years when Newt Gingrich and Republicans took over, and the budget discussions that would go on you know, it was much more substantive than now. You know, now it's always, there always is a rush to get something done. And so there's nothing happening that's regular. And so now people are talking about saying, you know what, I'm just going to leave, go do something else.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think you look at these members of the House, and that's one of the nice things about my job and about being around these places. It's easy to get jaded and frustrated with Congress in the abstract, and these guys are just, you know, worthless bums. But getting to know them, these guys, they want to do the right thing. They want to govern. They want to, most of them. I'm probably painting with too broad of a brush there. But no, you have absolutely palpable frustration that nothing's been done. I think there was a lot of high hopes going in that you had complete control of government. This is what we've been talking about. You know, this is, remember, starting with none of the levers of power in 2008, shifting in to say, okay, give us back power in 2010 and we're going to do X. And so you get back the House, and then you quickly realize, okay, we got the House, but you can't really do anything until you get the Senate. So you got to give us the Senate. That took two cycles. But then you get back the Senate, and we can only do so much with just the legislative chambers. We can play great defense, but until you get the White House, that's where the action is. So you win the White House against all the odds. You got all the ducks in a row, and you still realize that you might even be less productive and you know, less effective with this alignment. And so I think you're absolutely seeing a lot of frustration. You have if you look at what the returns have been, and they've actually been pretty muted so far. You have, in the past week, there have been several key ones that don't pretend good things going forward. But it's actually well below the sort of average over the past few decades, which should be scary for Republicans, because you're only clinging to a 24 seat margin. If Dems flip 24 seats, you're in trouble. And when you take a seat like Charlie Dent's, which wasn't even marginally in play, and suddenly it'll be targeted. If you take a seat like Dave Reichert's, which wasn't really in play, you know, it would be targeted, but he won the seat by 20 last time, and suddenly it might even come off the board. It's going to be really tough to field somebody in suburban Seattle that can, you know, defend Donald Trump. So you're putting seats in play that shouldn't be, and you have seats that should be in play that are going to be tough holes. And so I think you have all kinds of pressures. In red states, you have people who are seeking higher office from the House. You know, there's only so you can stick around and get you know, work your way up that whatever committee, or if you aspire to leadership, I don't know why you would, but you could do that if you want to stick around. That's a reason to stick around. But if you're in a state where you could run for governor, if you could run for Senate, there's a lot of those seats up this time. There's a lot of open governor seats. So you're seeing so far as many people saying, to heck with the House, I'm going to run for governor, I'm going to run for Senate, as you are people who are vulnerable or otherwise just throwing in the towel. So it's an interesting mix of motivations, but it's not going anywhere. You have a lot of people that are have never had tough races, that got scares in 2016, who might be thinking, do I really want to do this again? It's a grind to be in Congress, to raise the money required to run for re-election to Congress. So you could easily see this spiral out of control. And I think Molly Ball from The Atlantic pointed this out, is it's a vicious circle. People are leaving because it's going to be a tough cycle, and it's going to be an even tougher cycle because people are leaving. So it's not a good trend. I think whether Republicans keep the House is going to depend in a large part. You know, there's a lot of macro factors that you can't control and can't predict, but a lot of it is going to depend on how many open seats they have to deal with. So you really need to figure out how you can keep these guys around. And you can start by, you know, being productive and not undermining them at the presidential level.
That's great analysis, Liam. Thank you so much. I think we're gonna move it to wrap here. Before we do that, we do have a final question. And Jay, are you prepared for this?
Yeah. I mean, we're ready to go.
We are ready to go. Now, the question, of course, is, Liam Donovan, are you prepared for this?
I think I am, and I'm trying to think back at the previous you know, bits of trivia at the end, and I think I'm ready to go.
Don't think, Liam. Just go with your gut. So, for those who aren't aware, Jay and I have engaged in a series of intractable battles, which never quite resolve, although there is much bloodshed on both sides. We have decided to let our guests decide the matters at hand for us. And so on this crucial matter, this vital matter of cultural importance, we turn to you, Liam Donovan, and we ask you this question. Which is better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
So this is one I pondered because Jeff B., I think, gave a long-winded but wrong answer. And the answer is clearly the Stones.
Good man.
I think we can put that one to bed. That doesn't even deserve further scrutiny. I think the catalog, the longevity, you know, it's like everybody thinking that JFK is the greatest. You know, there's something about being sort of, you know, frozen in time and not having to languish in those later years. But I think it's clearly the Rolling Stones.
I happen to agree with you, Liam, and I applaud your good taste.
Neil's happy. He finally got a win.
Finally.
He got a Trump win, you know?
I think it's I just lost a losing streak that I was on.
Yeah, so. you had a cavort with that answer is like the equivalent of cavorting with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Yeah. So you just,
America already is great.
But yes, well, Liam Donovan, we thank you very much for being with us, and it was a very informative show. I know that I learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners learned a lot.
And thanks, guys.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Liam.
Sometime.
Anytime, you tell me.
All right, and follow LP Donovan on Twitter. You know,
that's
some
right.
Great, some
good plug.
Yeah, there you go. Good political insight, and you'll see him every once in a while on TV and in the pages of like National Review. So look out for that as well. Appreciate you being on. Have a great one.
Thanks, guys. You too.
All right. All right, Neil.
All right, Jay.
Another show. Look at that. It closes out with the Rolling Stones playing in the background.
Yeah, that's a departure from the usual.
A little Gimme Shelter, which is a great song. So
that is a good one. I like that one.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. As we said at the beginning of the show, we'll say at the end of the show, please go out, give us a review. Tell your friends to subscribe. We appreciate it. It puts us in front of more people, and you know that does well for us, and you know it allows us to, you know, a bigger profile. We bring on good guests like Liam and everybody else who's been on the show, which is informative. They're smarter than us for the most part. Maybe not Jeff, but anyway. All right. For Neil Doing, I'm Jay Caruso. We will see you next time on The Fifth Estate.